guess looking through all the topics, looking through all the topics for this this symposium, and sort of feeling perhaps a little bit out of place with my interests, I was just thinking as I was writing this fairly recently about the fact that I'm an Australian coming to America to talk about Australian poetic biography. And it dawned on me that I'm extremely drawn to the USA in order to conduct research. Despite my extreme fear of flying, I just can't stay away. And what perhaps seems more interesting is that each of the characters that I've written about have been drawn to the US in various ways. Mary Davies, of course, was born in New York and migrated to this coast to pursue her Hollywood stardom. And, of course, Hearst Castle, for those of you who have been there, is just a little bit below us on the map. And I spent a lot of time there being quite overawed by excess.
Luxurizing.
Just a little bit, sorry?
Luxurizing.
Just a little. Musician and composer Percy Grainger in the middle there, and I love this kind of strange photograph, as if he's kind of turning away from this kind of ethereal, godly inspiration and kind of instead looking towards the mountains and the grounds, which is very much how his music kind of, you know, he drew inspiration by having his feet on the ground rather than looking up at the stars. He spent 40 years in America, and we think of him as Australian, but he fell in love with America. And then choreographer George Balanchine, and this seems to me like a kind of poetic stance on the right-hand side. He was born in Russia. He's my current love affair, I guess, but found himself sort of inexplicably drawn to the US and was really, like, fell in love with Hollywood films, westerns, and the women, the look of women, and this idea of wide open spaces. And he dressed with cowboy string ties and cowboy boots and kind of was this seemingly kind of... He looked like this parodic figure, but what I really love about George Balanchine is that he genuinely loved all this stuff. And he created ballets. I haven't got a picture, but there's one called Square Dance that actually had a square dance caller chanting as the dancers kind of performed this hokey square dance, and another one called Western Symphony, which had a fiddler on stage. So one of the things that also drew me to Balanchine was his love of cats, and I just recently developed the brain parasite that causes you to love cats. And and I just wanted an excuse to show this picture, really. It's got nothing to do with what I'm talking about, but he taught his cat to dance and do other kind of things. So no, it doesn't really have a lot to do with what I'm talking about today, but it does, I guess, show that I have an American bias in my vision. And a recognition that recognises too that the poetic biographer is really brought to the forefront of any project. And this is one of the things that interests me about poetic biography. So what I want to talk about today are a few things that excite me about poetic biography. And I'm using the example of contemporary Australian poet Geordie Alveston, with whom I have a kind of love-hate relationship, to explore what such a genre, this idea of poetic biography, can and might do. So I won't talk too long about the first two books because I've spoken about them at length elsewhere, but just quickly, The Hanging of Jean Lee is a volume of poems on the life and death of Lee, who was the last woman hanged in Australia for her involvement in the murder of Melbourne bookie Pop Kent. And Alveston addresses the fact that while Ronald Ryan was the last man hanged in Australia, and is relatively well known. Jean Lee is an obscured historical figure. She says, "My intellect told me that this is a story that must be told, while my imagination told me this woman is like me in so many ways. I have experienced my own mistakes and misunderstandings, my own solitary confinement, and I found many instances where I felt, or felt I felt, Jean's presence along with my own when I wrote." So it seems that the poet was drawn to Jean not only for her relative historical absence, but by way of, albeit somewhat stretched, identification. This recalls a similar comment made by Canadian poet and critic Stephen Scobie, who notes that writers of documentary poems speak frequently of a sense of possession by the voices they assume. Paradoxically, such a possession can lead to a liberation of the writer to imagine aspects of her own personality which could not be expressed in the first-person lyric. So I don't want, nor do I think it particularly valuable, to discuss the extent to which Ulverstone's own personality is expressed through Jean Lee, but the concept of the poet's closeness to her historical subject, the way in which she acts as a kind of conduit for Jean's story, is useful to understand how the poetic form, and of course the poet, offers unique tools and perspectives to biographical writing. So in writing Jean Lee, Ulverstone conducted extensive archival research, accessing historical documents and public files relating to Jean's life and times. The book is divided into four sections resembling a tabloid structure, personal pages, entertainment section, crime supplement, death notices, and each have about between 11 and 15 separate poems. So this conceit brings the documentary aspects of the collection to the fore, yet while the overarching framework reflects aspects of the research that Ulverstone undertook to write the work and the material through which he encountered representations of Jean, it's the poet's attentiveness to subtleties of voice that creates a tension in the work between objective facts and subjective emotion. She listened to radio programs from the 1940s in order to capture, quote, that register and those cadences in some of the poems. She further says that she wove in police interrogations, court transcripts, newspaper headlines, advertisements, even nursery rhymes, and that each of these sources provided a different voice, a different kind of music for her poetry. And I've just put up an example of this is the opening poem, which adopts a really kind of cheesy sing-song birth column language. Dark delivery in Dinky Di Dubbo, a redhead cherub with waxen wings, born between wars in 1919, to Charles Wright and wife, their latest delight, is welcomed by siblings, two boys and two girls, etc. So, despite drawing on public files, the focus is not on the factual content of the archival records. Rather, Ulverstone incorporates non-historiographical poetic devices such as internal rhyme, part rhymes and alliteration to convey the details of Jean's place of birth, parents and family. I think also the sweet musicality of the tercets evokes a heightened sense of foreboding, because we know that the conclusion to her short life will not be so dinky-dye, and the spaces and line breaks that punctuate the poem indicate a less harmonious and less congruent portrait to follow. I'm also constantly drawn back to those first two words, dark delivery, the first two words in the whole collection, are moving. I think they're quite moving as a premonition of darkness and misery. So in this poem, the opening poem, for a subject whose life ended prominently in newspapers, Ulverstone begins the biographical document with another newspaper delivery, in which delight, congrats and best wishes are shadowed by anticipated darkness and despair. The next poem, I'm not going to read this, but just in the first few lines, it skips forward 4 years and is in the voice of a young Jean. So the poem conveys Jean's innocence at a young age. Phrases are repeated in a manner that mimics the repetition of expressions or turns of phrase by a young child learning to communicate. So there's a kind of interweaving of a progression following Jean's life, Jean's early life, from birth notice to childhood play, school report, starting to get in trouble and then following dangerous and difficult men. around the country. They're interwoven with flash forwards to her interrogation, confession, reportage, and other poems that follow her after her arrest. And towards the end of the collection, Lee is depicted as becoming hysterical after being given the death penalty, and Elveston matches that with a sort of flat fracturing of pauses and line breaks, helping to evoke this mental deterioration and providing a more texturally theatrical experience of the story rather than one based only in fact and information. There's poems in the voice of Jean, and there's other voices as well, Coroner's Report, Hangman's Handbook, etc. And this incorporation of various voices and points of view moves against and away from a more traditional biographical third-person narration, which enjoys the facade of objectivity and accuracy. Through poetic narrative play, it's as if we are provided with a set of various lenses or frameworks through which to identify and identify with Jean. In the context of this conference and some of the conversations that we've had, this could potentially be quite a rich area for discussion. I'm not going to spend too much time on it. It's just another work, a kind of could be considered a kind of collective portrait of the women who inhabited Botany Bay in the early days of white settlement, from transported convicts to the more well-to-do. So she does, Jodi Augustin does note in the notes section that she avoids discussing Indigenous voices, and I guess that's a possible point of conversation. We could talk about why, what motivated that decision, etc. I guess what I find interesting about this in a biographical sense is that it's kind of a collective biography, and there it begins with this sort of sea shanty in first person plural, where we picture a chorus-like gathering and a sense of the common experience of female convicts treated like anonymous sweepings from Britain. She then attempts to puncture this sort of blanket of homogeneity and provides insights into the lives of specific individual characters, in a sense restoring the humanity of these forgotten, or it's an attempt to restore humanity to these forgotten or downtrodden women. And she doesn't just combine this collective history to the convict mythology alone, but broadens the work to provide accounts of other women who encountered the tough conditions of the landscape during early settlement. Before I move on to the Book of Ethel, which is the work that I find of most interest at the moment, it's the most recent work of poetic biography, I just want to draw your attention to this quote by Cole Swenson that I continually come back to, because I find it so helpful in both my own writing but also in understanding what's going on with poetic biography. She says that in poetry, through interstices opened up by figurative language, ambiguity, juxtaposition, sound relationships and rhythmic patterns, room can be made for those aspects of truth that can't be articulated. The fully complex version of truth must incite the imagination of the reader, must get the reader beyond simply absorbing facts and into a responsive engagement with them, because that engagement is a crucial part of truth. It's the emotional part, which can't be told, it must be felt, which can be achieved through imagination, but not through idea. So to reflect on that, that quote by looking at the Book of Ethel. So the Book of Ethel draws from Augustine's own ancestry. It could be read as a poetic biography of the author's maternal great-grandmother. So Ethel Trehare was born in 1872 in Cornwall and emigrated to Australia at the age of 15. She found employment as a seamstress, which is quite relevant to this collection. She married the Reverend Harold Overend in 1898, and the poems provide miniature portraits of her life as wife and mother, travelling around the country as her husband moved parishes. They also address her efforts as a writer. She was a sort of amateur writer. And then she died in Melbourne at the age of 77 in 1949. Drawing information and material from archival documents and through site-based research, this book celebrates the less sensational moments of her ancestors' life, such as cooking in the heat of a lean-to scullery or buying peppermint sweets from an old Cornish woman. This is the opening poem, and it begins with an almost rapturous tone as Alberston ventriloquises her great-grandmother. And this is the voice of the entire collection, so it's quite different to the other two books in that it's just through this one perspective, albeit a fractured one. So life, we meet once more, you and I in concert, concord, happy agreement to do until done, my act, your stage, make lionet this, my bit part play, world with me aboard, a speck and then gigantic. More so than in those previous books as well, she's accentuating the breaths and pauses in the Book of Bethel, with more gaps and lacunae between phrases and single words, and a sense of wonder that's evoked with frequent use of capital letters and exclamation marks. From the outset, we get a sense of Ethel as an agreeable, humble, excitable and intelligent character, and this work reads as much more upbeat than the previous books. And the spaces provide a sort of lighter, formal texture to accompany Ethel's story. In this opening poem, the narrator views her life as a stage set for her bit part play. She realises the enormity of the world and that she is but a speck, though, as if the page offered a lens, we zoom in to see the details of this character's life, who is significant to the poet's ancestry. In a review of the book, David Gilby writes that there exists in the relative plainness of Alberston's form and language something of the unadorned simplicity of the Wesley hymns, so much part of the Methodist tradition to which Ethel, as a minister's wife, was bound, end quote. But this more sparse style also relates to Alberston's developing poetics. As she notes, quote, in a general sense, my poetry is becoming more spare, and I'm interested in paring down and stripping away anything and everything that doesn't have to be there. So the poems are getting smaller, less words, simpler words. This paring down simultaneously intensifies the weight of the few words that are present while making them multiply resonant. But patterns are also at play here. There's a 7x7 perfect square pattern, 7 lines of 7 syllables. There are also part rhymes and medial rhymes. But how do these elements help us to engage with the biographical narrative, that is, to understand Ethel? Understanding the author's research activities perhaps helps us forge some connections. She notes that she never met her great-grandmother because she died before she was born. In 2011, she travelled to Cornwall to see the house where Ethel was born and the surrounding town and landscape and buildings, and experienced other things like the food, the moors and the air, all of which influenced the poems that she wrote. But the poet also had her great-grandmother's letters and short stories, and family members gave her access to her Bible, her pen, crockery, and perhaps most importantly, some crazy patchwork she had done. She says of the poems in Ethel, I wanted them to be like pieces of embroidery. So I think this reveals some kind of fascinating background to the book's creation. The thought that the form and not just the content draws on and is influenced by the archival materials that Alberston encountered. So language and line are used here as if threads enabling a crazy patchwork or embroidered fabric that gestures towards her great-grandmother through material connection rather than authoritative fact. The Book of Ethel constitutes a meeting place, perhaps, of women artists across space and time connecting through a feminine pastime. So the 7x7 structure and the rhymes operate as structural metaphors for the kinds of patchworks and decorative embellishments offered up to Alberston during her research by family members and travelling encounters. This poem here explicitly refers to textiles and patchwork and the activity of stitching a remembrance. So just to wind up, this is a quote from Augustine. Jean Lee is about me. Botany Bay document is about me. These people whom I write about are my way of disguising the I. It's a conceit that I think all poets employ. And John Ritchie, in his short exploration of biography writing in general, notes similarly that a biography is always apt to become more an exploration of one's subject, an exploration of the author's self, making it a journey of self-discovery in the company of one's subject. So I guess the question is, what is the unique relationship that exists between the subject and author in the context of biographical poetry? More so than other forms of biography writing, biographical poetry brings the relationship of the author and the subject to the foreground, not only in the way the poet negotiates, arranges and presents factual details, but also in the way that the poet's personal style constitutes part of the vehicle conveying the narrative. Stephen Scobie sums this up nicely, stating that in a documentary poem, the documentary persona is often presented as a displacement, a reflection, a metonymy for the poet herself. The poet is identifiable within the poem. Her signature is there. She signs it. But she signs it in the name of the other, in the false name of the historical persona. The signature is true, but the signature is forged. And finally, Augustine's been criticised as not finding her voice because across each of her works, even though you can see a similar attentiveness to form and the economy of, like her poems are extremely economical, she's been criticised as not finding her voice. But for me, I think this aspect is not a failure, but a strength, because it shows that she's transforming and developing formal innovations to find new ways of speaking about the past and its subjects. So in this sense, she's realising that her I is a fluid subjectivity, not a constant construct. And that's all I say. Thank you.